This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 30th of April on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to episode 81 of Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up over the next hour, we'll find out if 3D printing has finally come of age.
But in the end, you don't buy the lamp because it's 3D printed, you buy the lamp because it's a nice design object. And the customer doesn't really care if it's made with technology A or B.
We'll talk bags and business with Marco Palmieri, CEO of Italian accessories brand Piquadro.
The idea was to merge these two ideas of leather good, technology and craftsmanship, and to create something different that speak about design and technology.
And I'll be joined in the studio by the founders of Bespoke Global, a virtual community of craftsmen and artists proving online retail can work for design.
You know, we've seen the success in a relatively short amount of time, in 2 years, really explode because these clients are all over the world. You know, we haven't done any print or online advertising. So this is people really searching for the work and hearing about it, reading about us and really connecting with the work.
Plus, we've still a few more tales to tell from this year's Salone del Mobile. We'll hear from Danish audio giants Bang & Olufsen, Dutch funksters Tjep, and Lebanese artist Wissem Notchi too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. ...3D printing is growing up. Many in the design community might associate it with brittle plastic prototypes or some of the less attractive iPhone cases on the market. But at the Inside 3D Printing Conference and Expo, held at the Javits Center in Manhattan, New York, it was clear that the additive manufacturing industry's days as a niche field were numbered. As the technology matures and materials diversify, designers are using 3D printing to create objects that appeal to consumers, not just as novelty items, but simply as good design. In New York, Shepard Lachlan reports on the rise of 3D printing in the design industry.
At the Inside 3D Printing Conference and Expo on Manhattan's west side, the trade show floor is opening to visitors. A man plays smooth jazz to demonstrate a 3D printed electric guitar shaped like an American flag. Desktop printers crank out tiny houses, dinosaurs, and busts of Yoda. A man's head, 3D printed in full color, revolves endlessly on a mirror affixed to a turntable. Like any trade show, it's a chance for vendors to promote their products to a specialized audience.
I'm Chief Marketing Officer with M4 Technologies. We manufacture a 3D printer that operates with regular office paper. We're the only paper-based 3D printer.
You'd be forgiven for thinking the whole thing was a bit of a gimmick. But step away from the hype and you'll find designers and technologists discussing exciting new projects that wouldn't have been possible a year or two ago.
My name is Joris Thiebo. I'm the creative director of .ngx by Materialize. So we're basically making state-of-the-art lamps, furniture for a very high-end level. And I'm specialized really in art and design. What we do is every year we make a collection, so around the theme. So in the beginning it was really to show off the technology, then we went into more the mathematical approach, and now we're really into new things.
Unlike traditional manufacturing, 3D printing allows designers to produce exceedingly complex shapes for essentially no added cost. Designers are not simply reproducing existing objects on 3D printers, they are creating entirely new products.
Lots of the designs take their inspiration from nature. Like, nature is basically the perfect creator, right? So shapes that can't be made in any other technology often come on my desk, say, this is what we want to do. So like the fractal table is a fractal growth table that takes inspiration from nature, how nature would grow a tree or a plant. Nowadays, more people know how to create files, but for me, somebody who can create a good file became a new craft. Lots of people can make files data. There are not a lot of people who can create good data. So it's like in fashion, it becomes almost like the pattern maker. It's something very interesting, I think.
Other designers are pushing the boundaries of 3D printing to produce architectural forms.
My name is Enrico Dini. I'm a civil engineer. So why printing buildings? Because it's cool. First of all, it's incredibly cool. When you see a new technology that is a digital manufacturing technology, who stops you in imagining scaling up the process to a large scale building process? Nobody.
Dini invented D-Shape, a technology for printing sandstone on a large scale. D-Shape is now a company with offices in Europe and America, and has been invited to print a concept house in Rotterdam. Dini also plans to use D-Shape to create stone structures for coastal restoration and maritime engineering.
You need to give a soul to the use of the tool. For instance, at the beginning, I didn't catch the meaning of 3D printing. So I could print a column, like a Roman column. Makes sense using 3D printing to print a Greek column? No, it doesn't match. It's like putting words that are old words with a new pencil. No, there is no harmony in those, you know? So algorithms and scripts and biomimicry applied to 3D printing make sense because they are at the same level of a good language for a new tool. All the other attempts to use 3D printing, you don't catch the deep meaning of the future.
Printing is also making its mark in fashion. Materials are improving, and printed clothing is behaving more like fabric. Mary Huang, whose company created the first 3D printed bikini, expects to see rapid developments in the technology.
Continuum Fashion is my co-founder, Jenna Fiesel, and me. We started working together just because we felt that there are relatively few people in the world who can both sew and code. So, you know, this is interesting. We should do some stuff. We just started working together purely on what we felt was interesting to us, and it turned out there are more applications out there for what we were doing. With 3D printing, we definitely hope that the printing part would get much better. For one thing, in 3D printed textiles, what we're making is essentially like, it's still low resolution if you compare to textiles. Like if you look at fabric, it's just made of thread. So once 3D printing gets to like that 0.1 millimeter resolution of being able to print flexible threads, then you can just make fabric that feels like fabric completely.
Joris Debo of Materialize is also working with fashion designers to push the limits of the technology. The company has collaborated with Dutch designer Iris van Herpen on a series of dresses.
She's a young Alexander McQueen, I would say, like very talented and a very architectural approach. So the first one was really a body armor. The second one was really to see what we can do with the geometry to make it more flexible, but still it was not really wearable. And the last step now is really that we have a material now that is very flexible and that almost looks like lace.
In adopting the futuristic technology of 3D printing, designers are not abandoning traditional craft methods, but instead working alongside them. A 3D printed clutch bag, for example, may still need an expert leather craftsman to finish the lining.
And that's something people don't imagine. Like they see, a 3D printer, you print an object, great, but for us, a design object needs hand finishing, so that's something very important. We have a know-how in a certain technology, but we don't have know-how, for example, when it comes to ceramics. We don't have know-how in how to fire or glaze ceramics. So why don't we put both worlds together and collaborate with other companies that do have like 100 years of experience in doing that certain craft. So that's something we're going to try to do now more and more. When it comes to metal, we start working with foundries to make bespoke metal pieces in bronze, stainless steel, aluminium. So this is a new direction for us as a company, as MGX. In the beginning, these lamps sold because it was made through 3D printing. It was a fantastic thing and something new. But in the end, you don't buy the lamp because it's 3D printed. You buy the lamp because it's a nice design object. And the customer doesn't really care if it's made with technology A or B.
Mary Huang of Continuum Fashion agrees.
Right now, there's a lot of attention on 3D printing. Like, we had never realized there would be this much hype about it. But essentially, you know, like, all good technology will disappear into the background. I mean, in fashion, a good design is a good design.
For Monocle, in New York, I'm Shepard Laughlin.
Thank you for that, Shepard. You're listening to Section D. We're off to Paris next. One of the great success stories of Italian design in recent years has been that of Pequadro, a company which specializes in luggage and accessories. Headquartered close to Bologna, Pequadro has rapidly expanded to more than 50 countries. Adding to its network of 95 stores, Pequadro has just opened its first branch in the French capital on the fashionable Rue Saint-Honoré. We sent our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson to the unveiling of the store, where he met the company's founder and CEO, Marco Palmieri. Tom began by asking how Pequadro came to be.
Pequadro was born 14 years ago as a leather goods company specializing in travel and business items. Pequadro meaning is a little bit complicated, but okay, my surname is Palmieri, start with P, and leather good in Italian language is pelletteria. P for P, P square, in Italian is Pequadro. And represent the our mood, our idea of tech that we want to put in our product and that is all around our company.
And what is the concept behind your product? What are you trying to create with each Pequadro product?
Considering that my personal background was in IT industries, the idea was to create one company that make leather good, of course, because my partner was specialized in the leather good and produced for many Italian luxury company as subcontractor. And the idea was to merge these two idea of leather good, technology and craftsmanship, and to create something different that speak about design and technology and not only fashion. So the environment was full of offer in fashion product specialized in women and fashion. The idea is to create something different in design and function and technology. The three word, very important word for Pequadro is design, comfort and technology.
And you also help people to become very organized because each Pequadro product has got all these different compartments for storing stationery, keys, and even more high-tech goods as well.
Yeah, the idea is that our target have one different approach of what the product is, and by not as a compulsive thing, but think a little bit more, want to know. Our target, one approach more analytic to the product and like to get information and to see that the product is tinkered from some other. And the reason why we feel full the product of features, idea, that we hope that simplify the life of the consumer and we put technology in the research, in the material, and of course we don't produce airplane or satellite, but in any case we are proud of our product.
And you're here in Paris today because we're standing actually in your new shop, and the design of this shop is wonderful. Tell us a little bit about the concept of the design of your new Pequadro shop, which I should say is on Rue Saint-Honoré in central Paris.
The designer, first of all, is Karim Azzabi, one Italian designer, architect. They follow Pequadro from many years, and the idea is to create one store with only one material, and the material is Corian, Dupont Corian, and it's completely white, very bright, and represent a mix between tradition and function and design. It's a perfect mix.
It's quite a sort of enveloping store as well, with the curve around the edge and the floor made of the same material as the ceiling. It feels like a bit like a cocoon inside here.
Yeah, exactly. A bit like a satellite, a cabin of satellite, yeah, something say like that. In the other side, this material is very strange because it's a synthetic material, but give a comfort mood. And at the end of the story, we like a represent Picquadro.
And you're here in Paris because presumably Picquadro is looking beyond Italy for its business. Up until now, Italy has been your number one market, but are you expanding in a great way overseas?
Yes, at the moment, unfortunately, the domestic market is Italy, and it's the biggest market for us. But the value of the brand is well represented, and from the success that we get around the world, and we want to invest much more from now to expand the brand everywhere. Paris is the second international, very important city where we create something important. The first one was Hong Kong, Queen's Road last year, and probably the next one is London.
Yeah, I think people will be very surprised to hear that you still don't have a shop in London. Is there a reason why you've hesitated to enter the British market?
No, absolutely no. UK market, in particular London, is a very competitive market. It's not easy to find a good location. But we are well represented, for instance, from Apple.com. Apple.com is one of the best customers that we have in UK. Our product is available in Apple.com and very, very well. We are between the best of seller.
That was Marco Palmieri, founder and CEO of Picquadro there, talking to our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up, it's headphones, human DNA and giant soap. Next, we'll be heading to Milan to visit a string of satellite exhibitions held during the 52nd Salone del Mobile. After this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D, where we find ourselves back in Milan. Regular listeners to Section D will know that over the last few weeks, we've presented a selection of our favourite people and products from the 52nd Salone del Mobile, which took place a fortnight ago in Milan. Well, coming up, we've a string of slightly left-field stories from the week-long design extravaganza. First up, we speak to Dutch design house Tjep, who've designed the world's first furniture and jewellery based on the image of someone's DNA profile. These pieces can be commissioned by people who want the ultimate bespoke piece of furniture or jewellery. Think wedding rings engraved with or in the shape of your partner's DNA profile. The Dutch design studio's Brandt Amery talks about the collection to our contributing editor, Alicia Kirby.
We're here at Milan to unveil the first ever DNA furniture. Essentially, working in collaboration with Dutch DNA, who is the company who actually produces it, and we are the design partner, the exclusive design partner. And it was a challenge to take a design from DNA. And so the process for the table and the furniture range that will come out of this is to use a DNA profile, which is a DNA profiling test, like the paternity test, and it gives you the genetic markers, which are unique to every person in the world. So it's taking these unique markers, and we use that to feed and actually develop the design. So these markers are then mapped against in a specific way that we're not going to say, because that's the secret sauce. And the result is, in this case, a very free-form table that is the table of Julia Walthaus. She is a contemporary dancer, a model in the Netherlands, and happens to be the daughter of the founder of Dutch DNA. The table is a very free-form and elegant expression of life, and that's really what we're seeking, to use this most unique pattern in existence to feed design and to create something that is absolutely unique.
And you guys have taken this kind of idea even further. So we've got a white kind of coffee table with a glass top, and you've even made jewelry from her DNA profile.
Yes, so the jewelry range is in two forms. You have the same free form, where really the life itself defines the design. And you see the unique characteristics really have this organic, fluid, dynamic element to it. And this is a family, and you can see how they almost connect, how you see how this could be a family. The jeweler is in the middle, mm-hmm. and the father and the mother.
And that's a necklace?
And that's a necklace, yeah.
And the two surrounding, are they earrings or pendants?
It's the same thing, they're just without the this mm-hmm. necklace, it's just about the chain. And then here you can see the pendants for a necklace, and these are called shifting hearts, and we take the DNA pattern against an existing form. And it's a great way of expressing anything. It could be a person, mm-hmm. someone, it could be yourself, someone you love, but we can also join DNA. So you could have two lovers creating their baby, quite literally. Imagine rings giving at a wedding that are formed from your paired DNA.
It's the ultimate present, isn't it?
It's the ultimate present. It's an expression of life.
That was Brant Emery of Tiep there talking to our Alicia Kirby. Meanwhile, over in the centre of Milan, we turned our attention to slightly more traditional tech. Danish company Bang & Olufsen has been designing and manufacturing audio products, television sets and telephones since 1925. Our associate editor, Nelly Gotcheva, caught up with Marie-Christine Schmidt, director, head of Creative Centre at the Craftsmanship Beyond Belief exhibition during Salone, to learn more about the brand's latest launches.
We live off understanding how consumers live. And this is, I think, where we also separate ourselves a little bit from the industries, that we design products for people's houses that you can actually decorate your home with. So for us, it's all about domesticating technology and creating pieces that you can take into your house. And this is where we start our process, by understanding people, how they live, how they act, how they live and breathe. And this is where we go, and we define the use cases, and we bring the designers in very early on. And we have an ongoing dialogue between the designers, our acoustic engineers, and our mechanical teams. And they have these internal battles to really make sure that we create a product that delivers on both sound and design.
So how long would those battles usually take? How long would it take you to create a new product from scratch?
It's different how long time it takes. We have products that we are actually very good at getting out fast. And we have some of our bigger products that takes a long time because we have new technologies and everybody's pretty passionate and invested. So we have our fights, but I think it's with a twinkle in the eye. And this is what creates some of the uniqueness about Bang & Olufsen, is that we have these passionate people that will not give up without a fight.
So can you just walk me through to some of your new, like some of your latest models?
Yeah, actually we're standing next to one of our latest models. It's a Bang & Olufsen TV called Beovision 11. It's a fantastic TV. We launched it in October 2012. It's a product that has a unique design. I mean, the design philosophy of this product was actually that all beautiful things needs to be framed. So the product has a very beautiful, very unique and distinct design. And as you can see on the product, this is a product that prioritizes sound. So where a lot of products out there strive to become thinner and thinner and thinner, and they compromise on sound to be able to deliver that, we say we will not do that. So we prioritize space for sound in the product. So in this Beovision 11, you have six speakers, each of them with its own amplifier, and you get a fantastic, powerful product, and beautiful product.
It is beautiful indeed. Can you explain something? What about those tiny speakers? They're just the model of one of your key products, but can you just walk us through them also?
Yeah, I think that what you're looking at is small design models. So when we start our design process, some of the stuff that we do a lot is that we have many models. We do rapid prototyping, we test, we look for proportions, we look for fit, we look for color, material, finishing, we look for all of these different things throughout the design process. So we have many models during the process. And what you're looking at is a design model for a product we launched, a fantastic product called the Beoplay A9, so it's under the Beoplay brand. And we launched it also in the fall 2012. And if you turn around, you can actually see the design of the product, which is the vision for Beoplay A9 was to create a product that had a furniture feel to it. So instead of putting the chair in the corner, you would put this object in the corner, and that would give you a fantastic, beautiful experience.
And great sound quality also.
And amazing sound quality. So this one is very powerful speaker. It plays up a big party, I would say. And it has all the right nuances to give you that intimate feeling with your experiences. So if you're alone, and then you can really take it away on the party side.
Who are Bang & Olufsen pieces for? Do you have more like private clients, or are you targeting more corporate clients, residential, retail?
I think that we are targeting end consumers, so ordinary people, and this is our primary target. We have 700 retailers and across the world. Yeah, so we are there for everybody basically. We do have an enterprise department that takes care of the more B2B side of it, but this is our primary target.
So having noticed some of your products being more accepted or more wanted in certain parts of the world compared to others being like really sought after in others?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely something with the sizes of people's houses. And so in some of the cities where people live in the smaller apartments, they definitely go for the smaller items. And I also think that there's a demographic in terms of the bigger cities where you have more urban people living in more urban lifestyle. They might tend to go for the B&O Play segment, whereas for when you move a little bit out of town, they have more space, bigger houses, and then tend to buy into the Bang & Olufsen brand. So we do see a difference there.
And also, we are here at Celoni right now. Why is Bang & Olufsen at Celoni? How important is this fair for you?
I think that Celoni is very important because we as a brand, we look very much at what is going on the interior scene. And for furniture design and how people actually decorate their house, we're very much about the surfaces of our products, so the textiles, the tactility of the product, the materials used. So we want to fit into people's houses, not taking over, putting in, you know, big black boxes. We want to make sure that you actually enhance your house when you buy a Bang & Olufsen product. So this place is a fantastic place for us to be because we see what's going on, and we find that the design audience actually show a big interest in us as well.
Marie-Christine Schmidt, Director, Head of Creative Centre at Bang & Olufsen, talking to our Nelly Gotcheva there. Next, we venture to the Lambrate area of Milan to talk to Lebanese artist Wissam Notchi, whose solo exhibition showcased a gigantic bar of soap and a sink made of soap, alongside a white armchair modelled on the shape of the female sex.
I'm presenting 79AU, which is the name of Gold Element.
That's the name of your exhibition, 79AU.
It's different works. Each one looks at a different time in my process development over the past 2 years. And the collection is like different pieces. You have like from recycled little pieces to very, very natural pieces to ecological pieces.
And right now we're looking at what looks to be a huge bar of soap that's about 1 meter long and 50 centimeters 19. Wide.
Yeah, this is it's called Sinbad. This is a soap bar composed of olive, palm, and coconut oil, ultramarine for color, lavender essence, gold leaf, and sea salt. It's a bathing experience, really. You put this out in the garden, in a lush garden, you just sit, sort of bathe with it, with a cloth and some water. There's another version of Sinbad soap, which is a soap sink you have over there. Also, this is another take on a sink, and maybe the sink for ablutions in the Middle East. It makes it kind of interesting, yet it's ephemeral as a work. And then we have like the different pieces, whether it's the rattan chair rocker, which takes an ancestral sort of material and bends into form. It's just a grass, it's a root, it's handmade, it's heated and bent into form. This is a limited edition of a chair that I'll show you in a little bit outdoors.
And you have another chair over here which is covered in, is it sheepskin?
Yes, it is sheepskin. This is a take on Feuille de Vigne Femelle, a famous work by Marcel Duchamp. It's a mold of a female sex, that he did in a study in the series of Étant Donné. So this is just an interpretation of it, and it's in two versions, really. The skin is for winter, so it's really warm. You could have it in a chalet or in the snow, and you uncover it, and then it gets to be sort of concrete and fiber mesh, therefore for the outdoors, and it can be just left out. Two-seater, four different positions, quite a piece.
That was Lebanese artist Wissam Notchi talking with our Alicia Kirby there in the Lambrate district of Milan during Salone. Back in central Milan, we dropped by La Pelota, the stunning former gymnasium on Via Palermo, where an interesting conglomerate of young, independent, largely British brands was showing. London-based furniture studio Case, founded in 2006 by Paul Newman and Sheridan Coakley, was one of them. And our associate editor Nelly Gochiva caught up with Newman, who's been a regular at Salone for the last 10 years. She waded straight in and asked about his take on the fair's development over the last decade.
I think what has happened with the new fairground at Perot, that it's further out, it's created a much sort of higher concentration. There's many more exhibitors in town now. And so in a way that's good. I think it's very good for the visitor, but I think for the exhibitors, it's difficult because there's so many options. You know, initially it was just Tortona was an area where people went, and now there's Brera and Lambrate and everywhere else. And so, you know, for commercial visitors, I think there's an awful lot to see, too much to see really in the time they've got. So as an exhibitor, I think you're always fighting to try and get people to where you are if you're not in the fair. So it's good and bad, Milan. It's a great place to be, and it's the exhibition of the year. But nevertheless, there's so much going on, it's often hard to get noticed, I think.
So what are your expectations of this year's edition then?
For us, we can justify being here in the fact that we're meeting our existing customers. And that's a good opportunity to do that because they're in, you know, we have customers in Singapore and Thailand and China and America. So that's a good opportunity anyway. And then if we pick up new customers, then that's a bonus for us.
What are the international markets that you're targeting?
We're finding that Asia is really kind of strident, really moving forward. You know, countries like Thailand, where historically you didn't see them as commercial opportunities, they're becoming very developed and advanced. We do very well in Singapore, which is a small country, but we do well there. We're starting to sell now into China, which is interesting. So I think I think Europe is a little bit dead, a little bit stagnant. That's a polite word for it. So I think, you know, Asia's, there's lots of opportunities in Asia.
And can you just tell me a little bit more about your newest product?
Well, we've got a mixture of things. We've got sort of development of existing ranges that are doing quite well. So we've our outdoor range, EOS range, we've added to those products with a lounger, some other chairs, some other tables. And the same with the cross range, where we've added some solid wooden top circular tables and oval tables and coffee tables. And then in terms of brand new products, the Vitrina range, you know, which is this display range with the oak frames and the glass and the coloured interiors, which have been done by a Mexican architect called Alejandro Villarreal, and they're quite interesting, a bit of a diversion for us.
What are you designed for? Like, what are your key and main customers type wise?
We're very focused on making commercial affordable furniture. You know, that's a real priority for us. You know, that it needs to be a combination of nicely designed, well made, but also affordable. We try and manufacture it to a price point that, you know, makes it sell in volume.
What is your take on the current state of British design?
Well, I think Britain's always been at the forefront of all sorts of design. You know, I think we have a culture that encourages kind of irrational and rational thought together. You know, I think that's always been the case, whether it's been music or art or anything. In terms of manufacturing, I mean, there's very little manufacturing in the UK. You know, that's the truth of it.
Where do you make your product?
We still make a lot in Europe. We make a lot of upholstery in Italy, and then we make a lot of the solid wooden products in Eastern Europe, either Lithuania or Slovenia. We make some things in the Far East, but not much. We make the aluminium outdoor things in the Far East.
And what is next for you? Any exciting collaborations or projects you're working on?
No, not really. We haven't got anything exciting at all going. But no, we have got some. We've got some good products coming through. We've got some new products coming through. What we try to do as well, which is important to our development, we work very closely with the retailers we work with. So, for example, we work closely with a company called Design Within Reach in the States, and we give them exclusivity for the product. So we're very much dialed into what they're doing, and we try and match our development to what their needs and expectations are as well. So we try and work in a fairly commercial way. I know that doesn't sound particularly interesting from perhaps a journalistic point of view, but it makes commercial sense for us. You know, we need to sell, we need to make money, basically.
And where is the money now? Asia?
America's doing well. America's come back. You know, I think Europe is still in recession, but I think America is genuinely climbing out of it.
That was Paul Newman, co-founder of Case Furniture Studio, talking to our Nelly Gotcheva there at the Salone del Mobile in Milan. You're listening to Section D. We're leaving Milan next and coming back to the studio at Midori House to hear about a quietly successful online design venture called Bespoke Global. That's after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Bespoke Global is a 2-year-old online retail venture that's beginning to turn heads. As you might expect from its name, it deals with craftsmen and artists rather than large-scale manufacturers. And connecting the world's craftsmen and women both to each other and to new customers is proving a very successful venture. Bespoke Global's founders, Pippa McCardle and Gwen Carlton, both from New York, joined me in Studio 2 to tell me more.
Bespoke Global really is a, we consider, premier destination for artists and designers who specialize in custom and made-to-order work across sort of luxury products within, you know, lifestyle and also home. Really authentic artisans really specialize in certain techniques from all over the world.
You're both from New York. Did it start
Yes.
in New York and with artisans and craftsmen in New York and has sort of expanded out from there?
Absolutely. I mean, Gwen really can probably tell the story a little bit better than I can about, she's an incredible artist, so.
We did start in New York, but we really, even at our first launch, we had artists from all over the world. For the most part, people that I'd known for the last 10 or so years making bespoke lighting. So just artists whose work I really admired that I'd worked on projects with, who I managed to get to say yes.
That's very important, I imagine.
Yeah, in the beginning that was very important.
Why do you think the need for a digital platform to showcase this work?
Well, the design industry, as you know, is a little bit sort of slow to move into sort of change. And I think the internet is an incredible place to really provide sort of empowerment to the sort of general consumer. And traditionally, these artists and designers are really kept apart. And they're kept apart not only by their geography, but also contractually. They're actually not allowed to actually be together in one place because of contractual reasons, the showrooms and so forth that represent them. So I think it's kind of amusing to think that in this day and age that the best of the best cannot be put together in one place. So, you know, people are looking for this level of work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that classic proposition when someone has incredible work and someone's trying to find them, but they can't. So if you provide an outlet for that or a forum for that, you know, we've seen this success in a relatively short amount of time in 2 years really explode because these clients are all over the world, Russia, Australia, all through the UK. You know, we haven't done any print or online advertising. So this is people really searching for the work and hearing about it, reading about us in newspapers or hearing us on the radio. So thank you so much for having us and really connecting with the work.
You mentioned clients there, and I'm interested, what sort of clients do you have and how do people find you? You mentioned there that it tends to be word of mouth, but are these architects, interior designers, are they just curious people who want to buy into something that they know has been handcrafted and has a story behind it and isn't going to be found in the shelves of Walmart down the road?
I think, you know, primarily we solve problems. We're a service company. So people who are looking for incredible work that solves a problem, custom and made to order, normally is because it needs to fit somewhere or it needs to be made for a client. So it's either, you know, general consumers who want a certain piece that they want a certain way, or architects, interior designers, private jets, and also yachts.
Assuming they're not hanging a chandelier in a private jet.
Why? why would you assume that?
What is the range, though, of the things that you have? I mean, you mentioned, Gwen, you obviously come from an artist background.
Sure. So we are all categories across home. So everything from lighting to case goods to beds to you name it. And then we recently launched our leisure collection, which is sporting and gaming, which is a tremendous amount of fun if you haven't taken a look. So, and that's everything from leather falcon hoods to fly fishing rods and reels to really stunning wooden kayaks and canoes by Nick Shada, who also happens to be in the permanent collection of MoMA as well as on our website. So,
and how do you, I mean, you mentioned also that the tides turn slightly. Instead of you going to people now come to you. How many craftsmen do you represent?
We currently have 75 artists on the actual website, but we have around 300 in due diligence right now. How we sort of select the artists and designers is we look at their body of work, we look at their clients, we look at their production techniques. You know, we're very, very thorough. So not everyone
makes the grade. No, good, because obviously quality is key to keeping the service that you offer at that level, that people trust what you do and come back. Or tell their friends about it too.
Absolutely. And, you know, the leisure collection came around because our clients were coming to us and saying, thank you so much. You know, I enjoyed working with you. Do you know anyone who does backgammon boards? I want to get a present for my wife. Or I really love fly fishing, but I want something super custom. And do you know who does that? So, you know, we were naturally sourcing things for our clients that were outside our scope of work, right? It's really a part of our service component going above and beyond for our clients. So we amassed this kind of incredible collection just by servicing our clients that Gwen and I thought, well, there's obviously a need for this. We don't even represent this and people are coming to us. So that's why we launched the leisure and sporting, because our clients, you know, have passions. They're connoisseurs.
And they know what they want.
They know what they want. Mm. But also they sort of want to sort of be a part of the experience of creating something and having a story to tell, you know, social currency, so to speak. So I think that's definitely an area that we've seen growing as well, which is interesting.
And to take it back to the artists and the craftsmen and the makers that you represent, I mean, they must love the fact that now they have a new avenue on which to, or a platform on which to get their work, the recognition that their work maybe hasn't had in the past.
Absolutely. I think the founder of the company, Gwen, coming from that background, sort of sets the tone for the company. I think we look at things very differently. I think we've structured the business very differently. We're very artist-centric and service-oriented towards our clients. So really, these artists and designers, I mean, they're passionate about creating best-in-class work. They do not compromise. But they're not particularly interested in having an e-commerce site or marketing. They don't know how to, nor have the resources. It's, you know, it's challenging to be able to do that for one person, for I don't care what company you are. So I think by collaborating and bringing them all together, it's sort of they all rise together. And I think what we've been able to do, if someone's looking for a candle holder or, you know, a desk, all of a sudden they see someone else's work. So it's fantastic.
Creative commingling.
Yeah. And, you know, it encourages people to explore other mediums and avenues and techniques as well. So I think for all of the artists, it's very beneficial. And we, you know, we take it very seriously.
That was Gwen Carlton and Pippa McCardle, the founders of Bespoke Global, talking to me there. There are so many factors to consider when designing an interior that the simple question of colour can very easily get lost in the maelstrom. Furniture, fittings, floors, windows, layout, artwork, when sometimes a lick of paint can make all the difference. London interior designers and acclaimed joiners Plain English have launched a new range of paint that adds depth as well as a bit of humour to the interior designer's palette. With names like boiled dishcloth, rice pudding and drafty passage, the range doesn't seek to add glamour, but rather a tongue-in-cheek English earthiness. Monocle's David Pleasant went along to talk paint and colour at the range's launch.
My name's Adam Bray, and we are in the scullery at the Plain English showroom in Marylebone, which is painted a colour called Army Camp, which is derived, a colour derived from a 1940s camouflage paint card that we found. which was a direction that I was very interested in going, primarily because camouflage colours are derived by their very nature from natural colours and natural dyes. So I was very keen on the idea of using that in a kitchen.
And in terms of your involvement in this new range that we see wonderfully painted on the joinery and surfaces of this showroom, what was the beginning of the process? How did you come to this new range?
I'd done a range of colours already for myself, for other decorators to use, that were based on colours that I'd mixed specifically for other jobs that I'd done. And I found that plain English had taken a very bright green that was a sort of modernist 1930s colour, bright apple green, and used it on one of their kitchen units. And it was so out of keeping with what I associated their style to be that I found Katie Fontana, who's the owner, and I had lunch with her. And I had a conversation where I suggested we design a range of colours for her that were not what you would expect from a company like this. Sue Skeen, who is a fantastic stylist who works with Katie at Plain English, had these ideas, I think, to make it feel very much in line with the Plain English vision. So they are very English, the names, like coal scuttle, starched apron, dripping tap, rice pudding. I mean, one of the colours that we tried to find was a colour that would look like a sort of perfect, slightly burnt, creamy rice pudding.
And if for some of our foreign listeners, rice pudding is a very British dessert. So kind of describe that colour. I mean, it's really specific, isn't it?
Well, rice pudding is made of sort of rice boiled with milk and vanilla. And there's a sort of yellowy milkiness about it. When I originally wanted to do a colour that was like a dirty white, that was the kind of colour that you'd see if you were in the back stairs of a country house and you opened a sort of larder door that hadn't been opened for 30 years and it had hundreds of grotty fingers pouring at it.
And did you achieve that? Do you feel like it's the kind of, if you slap that paint on your walls, have you got that feeling pretty much immediately?
I think you can try. I think, you know, you need to I think it always needs to be grubbed up a little bit. We always try to, I think, with the colours, to knock them back a little bit. I mean, my instinct is always to make colours quite bright, but in London and in England, it's very difficult because the light here is not so good. As the further north you go or the further south you go, you can use brighter colours. But we've tried to keep as much brightness as we can. I think rice pudding, well, it certainly looks like what I had at school, so I'm never going to use it in my kitchen.
My name's Katie Fontana. I'm the creative director of Plain English, and we're here today in our Marylebone showroom because we're launching our first ever colour collection, which is a range of colours for cupboards.
And tell us a little bit about the colours. They've got some quite intriguing names.
I like Inky Nib very much. I like Army Camp very much. And I like Rusty Nail very much.
Rusty Nail, it's a great name. How would you go about describing that colour?
I think probably the closest thing that you could say it's like is Chinese lacquer red. The starting point was to try and recreate some of those lost colours from the first half of the 20th century that were kind of everyday colours up until Farran Ball were invented, etc., etc. That was our starting point. Some of them have now moved a little bit further away from that. But as I say, so we wanted an army green, we wanted a Chinese lacquer, we wanted a good white, we wanted a good cream, we wanted a nice deep grey. Although, as I say, our starting point was, you know, early 20th century colours, you know, those old utilitarian colours, I think it's gone slightly away from that. I mean, it seems very New York-y to me. I don't know why, this room. There's something about it that keeps making me think of New York. So it's gone its own way and become its own thing now. But as an interior designer, although I designed the cupboards and the detailing, and I've had to teach myself to scrutinise joinery and study it, as an interior designer, I'm quite keen on the high drama of the space itself, you know, making it an intriguing space. I like sort of doorways where there's something interesting going on through the doorway, which makes you want to go through there.
In terms of what colour can add to that drama, yes. How do you use colours and a colour scheme? How would you use Rusty Nail? How can you go about kind of mixing and matching those colours?
Well, what we've done here is we've tended to use some of the more dramatic colours as highlight colours. So, you know, in this showroom, which is predominantly this mid bluey grey, we've got one little isolated window in the rusty nail. The red, you know, little pinpoint, and then we've painted the little lampshade over there. We actually played around a lot with the colours here.
How many coats are there in all? How many different attempts did...
The insides of the cupboards have been about four different colours.
That was Katie Fontana from Plain English talking to our researcher David Pleasant there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. But fear not, we'll be back next week with a follow-up interview from Salone with one of the busiest ladies in the design world, Patrizia Moroso. We'll also be talking about odd paint names and maps for the blind too, so be sure to tune in then. This show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, here's a glorious song for spring or autumn, whichever hemisphere you're listening from. It comes from the talented trio of siblings Haim from America, and it's called Go Slow. Enjoy it, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.